Hi folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, April the 9th, 2026, and that means it is time for our expert counsel Q&A show for the week. And I've got a great lineup for you today, some folks you hear from a lot. So people we haven't heard from in a while today, we always hear, I shouldn't say always, we 99% of the time hear in our leadoff from Ron Paul and Liberty Highlights. In this case, we're going to hear today from Dr. Ron Paul and his co-host Dan McAdams. And a question is Iran becoming a redo of Afghanistan and Vietnam, where we won every battle but lost the quote-unquote war? I'm going to have a little bit of a pushback on this one, not so much with the wishing we weren't doing this, but the analysis. And I think emotion is coming into this analysis for a lot of people, and it's resulting in a very clouded, definitive proclamation of things like Iran's winning or it's a tie. No, it's not. Not even in any way. It doesn't mean that it's a good idea, and it doesn't mean that we're going to come out of this with a really great result. But I think there is a propensity right now to be overly negative, and I'll kind of point that out more as a exercise in critical thinking than a pushback on Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams. Next up, Antonio Gatto, who we haven't heard from in a little while, had a great question come in on selling your home and using a realtor or doing a FSBO, which is for sale by owner. He's going to give a great answer. I'm going to tell you right out of the gate, he is going to come down on the side of using a realtor. He's going to give great advice as to why. I'm going to throw in a little bit on top of this one, and I'm going to talk about something I call active management, which when most people hire somebody, they do not engage in active management. They're lucky if they even engage in passive management. Instead, they engage in what I call response management, which means whenever they tell you something, you give them an answer. Like, we have an offer, do you want to take it, right? Or, you know, can you get out of the house? Okay, you know, on this day at this time so we can share your house. Like, that's the extent of the management people do with a realtor. I find this to be a massive, 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 and I mean massive mistake, because the problem is there are an awful lot of real estate agents that are not really good at what they do. And even some that are good at what they do are not good at some of the things that they should be doing that I think a lot of them are not even aware of. I actually wrote a book about this, and I have a link in the show notes for it today. I co-authored it with a guy named Dustin DeFriest, who I haven't heard from forever, but it's still a very useful tool. And if you have Kindle Unlimited, you can get it for free. Nick Ferguson will talk about harvesting fodder and storing it as something called tree hay for livestock feed. Super simplified way of doing it, too. Mike Melito, we'll talk about inspecting and modifying older firearms, making sure that there's nothing wrong with them, and should you modify them, especially when we get into the world of maybe mil-serp or really older weapons. Joel Riles has a segment today on stopping unwanted behavior in your dogs. I will remind you when it comes up of what I'm about to tell you now, and that is that I screwed up. And not in some, you know, catastrophic way or anything, but I did screw up. Somehow, this segment in my folder in my email program that I use to manage all this got missed, and this is from November. There's only one reason that matters. At the end of the segment, he's going to mention a sale on puppies. I don't think he's still doing that, but I didn't want to not play it, and it just the way it kind of ends, if I had tried to cut that out with editing, it would have made the whole thing clunky. So I just left it there, and who knows? You can always ask for a deal, right? Then the last one I have something for you. I kind of mentioned this, but I'm going to dive a little deeper into it with you today. There is an AI tool called Notebook LM, and I've mentioned it quite a few times on the show. However, this week, as I've been writing my third book, because yes, the second book is about done with editing. Laura says it'll be back to me this weekend. And then the second edition of Laws of Life 1 is going to her. And so we should have, within a couple months, a drop of Laws of Life 1 second edition revised and Laws of Life book 2 at almost the same time. That's pretty exciting. But I've been working on this new book, that is called Me, Myself, and AI. It's about developing the skill set to be a better leader, especially in the workplace, for the pioneering user of AI in this transitional stage. This looks a lot to me like the adoption of the internet by corporate America from 1995 to about 2010, that 15-year cycle. And I have been using my system that I'm putting in the book to write the book, and it has been blowing me away. I said to Tom yesterday, if I was writing a book that was like a horror story, I feel like I have Stephen King on speed dial. And every time I need a little bit of advice, Stephen King is there to help guide me through it. That's the type of entity I created to help me with the creative aspect of writing the book. I'm not even talking about editorial yet. However, I did something that blew me away with using Notebook LM. And then it resulted in me finding some other things. And so I'm going to come across with the use of this tool today as an author. But if you are doing anything that requires communication with other people, putting together presentations, trying to develop more deep understanding of certain things, there are some things that have been added to this recently. And if you're using the app on your phone instead of a computer, some of them do not appear to necessarily be as configurable. This might be one you want to use a browser for, at least for the podcast type output. This is incredible, and I think it's going to be really exciting for you when you hear it, and I bet you it'll conjure up something in your head that you're working on that, hey, I can use this tool for that thing. And that's what I'm always trying to do, give you more tools. Before we go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams, though, I have a freaking awesome, awesome, awesome announcement. I know some of you during the lead up to when the content actually starts, you're driving in your car home from work or something, you kind of glaze over. Listen to me now, okay? Listen up, class, okay? This is badass. I was approached by the owner of a company called The Case Place. The Case Place sells absolute top-end hard storage cases, okay? Think Pelican, Hardig, SKB, and others. Like, the best gear there is. But what they're doing is they're obtaining their gear from overstocks, government returns. Some of it is used, but it's all been inspected. It's in great shape. And they are selling for 50 to 80% off retail. I'm going to say it again. They are selling brands like Pelican and Hardig for 50 to 80% off of retail. Okay. Again, most of this inventory comes from government surplus, overstock, and liquidations. In other words, this is gear. It was made to do a job, not sit on a shelf looking pretty. They bring it in, they go through it, inspect it, repair anything it needs fixing with factory parts, clean it up, and send it back out ready for use. Now, when somebody tells me something like that, I'm like, okay, but how long have you been doing this? Right? Like, how long have you been doing this? Well, apparently they started, or at least one of their major marketing channels has been eBay. I love when people sell on eBay. And the reason, I know it costs some money to do that and all, but the reason I love eBay is because eBay doesn't fake its reviews. So when I dug into their reviews on eBay, they had almost 3,000 reviews. 99.5% positive feedback. I don't need to hear any more. I know what the gear is. I know what it costs. I know what I can buy it for. And I know it's going to be delivered dependably. So they're a new sponsor. That's not even a big announcement. MSB, you guys get another 10% off of stuff that's already discounted, 50 to 80%. So they are not just a new sponsor, they're a new MSB vendor. I consider this a big win for you guys. One of my strategic objectives this year is to bring on at least 8 new premium vendors of the MSB. I'm talking about companies at this level. So I'm going to throw one more thing before we go into Dr. Paul and Dan here. If you think you're this good, and you have a company, and you want access to my best customers, send me an email, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC vendor in the subject line, and tell me what you've got and what you want to do. On top of that, if you know somebody that owns or manages a company that you think would be a good fit, talk to them and see if they would be interested, because we can move some product for them. We reach a lot of people, especially if it's the right wheelhouse that we're talking about. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on their assessment of what's going on in Iran right now.
Well, the next step is supposedly going to be our talks in Pakistan. Now, J.D. Vance, the vice president, was already in Hungary having a little pep rally there before their elections. Apparently, he's going to go on to Afghanistan, where he will, as I understand it, at least meet face-to-face perhaps with Iranian officials. Now, there is word that the old tag team of Kushner and Witkoff may be going as well. I think that's a terrible idea because those are the guys who double-crossed the Iranians twice. Three times would not be a charm. They're also known as agents of Netanyahu more than agents of Israel or of the United States. So that is a big that is the next big step. Whether anything will happen after that. Now the Iranians, they obviously view this as a victory. The U.S. did request this despite what Trump says, this ceasefire. And if you have this, you know, the greatest military in the history of the world is what we're told our military is. And you have this little pipsqueak in the Middle East, at least that's how it was viewed in the U.S., has been able to stand up to the U.S., has at the very worst had a draw with come to a draw with the U.S. Well, that's obviously a victory. But people like Hegseth, who can't seem to keep his mouth shut, are continuing to brag and proclaim what an amazing victory it is. No, I just want to show you this because I know you will like this, Dr. Paul. It will remind you of something. Put on that post by Kelly Greco. She's with the Stimson Center and also an adjunct at Georgetown. She makes a very important point. Hegseth said Operation Epic Fury was an historic and overwhelming victory in the battlefield, a capital V military victory, to which Ms. Greco said, that mindset is the problem. The U.S. won every battle in Vietnam and Afghanistan and still lost both wars. Tactical victories aren't strategy. That's a great point, isn't it?
Boy, that's for sure. We went 6,000 miles to do this, and how can the people with a little common sense think that spending billions and billions of dollars when we're $40 trillion in debt, and that we can keep doing this forever? We undermine our liberties, we create more wars, more people die, and it goes on and on.
So like I said, I think there is a lack of absolute 100% honest objective analysis of the situation right now. I mean, the left is all, that's the case, right? But we're not talking about leftists here. We're talking about constitutionally focused libertarians when we look at Dan and Ron and Chris, who wasn't in today's segment. And so I'm not attacking them personally, but I do think that we are all subject to bias. And I think that in particular of that group, the one that is the most opposed to just everything that Israel touches is Dan. I'm not saying I'm pro-Israel in a lot of ways. I very much object to many actions that they take. Of course, I could say that about any government of any country, and some more than others, and they're pretty high on the list of people that I object to. My concern here, though, is that, and I'm going to call it exactly what it is, anger, right? If not all the way to the level of hatred, can blind a person to objective analysis. Comparing bombing Iran, strategically taking out just about everything they have to project force, to outright engage in invasion of Afghanistan, okay? It doesn't track. The same thing with Vietnam. Vietnam was even a bigger mess because you had a country that we had willy-nilly cut in half, and we're trying to protect half of it from reattaching itself to the other half. In a war that we had no business being involved in. That's where they're similar. We have no business being involved in the way that we are with this conflict. However, there are objectives to this that are not take over Iran. In fact, I have not heard take over the Iranian landmass as an objective put out yet. There are three objectives stated if you go into the macro, like the top level, and I think one is bullshit that is designed to gin up support, and I'll save that one for last. The number one is to remove Iran's ability to significantly project force in their region through proxies and through their armament. I don't know how much we have done to the proxies yet, except they're financially hurting, and their proxies are funded, and that's how they make them work, okay? And so there's a big disruption to the funding of them, but their ability to project force with things like missiles, bombs, their navy, etc., has been The word that the president keeps using is decimated. That's not an accurate word. Decimated means remove one in ten. Whatever it would be, nuevitated, I don't know. What is the Latin for nine? Instead of one in ten, it's like nine in ten are gone. All right, so I think that half of that objective has been well achieved. Not because I'm rah-rahing it, because I'm being objective about the objective, okay? The next part of it is to prevent Iran in the future from closing the straits. Now, what the critics are saying, and they're accurate, the strait was open before he started. Now he got it back open and said it's a win. Yeah, but is this the first time? Is this the first time? No, it's not. It's not even the first time this decade. Okay? The Iranians have used that as a hammer to project force since 79. Mess with us and we'll close the strait. Well, maybe people are tired of this. I don't know. I'm not saying that it's worth going to war for. I'm saying that's the objective. I do believe that if you continue to pound them long enough, assuming that can be kept up without congressional intervention, you can collapse the regime to the point where it's like, okay, we just care about controlling our country. We need to lay off of this. And you can set them back 20, 30 years. Easily. Easily. I also think that, like, the absolute erratic, over-the-top shrieking response to his lunatic, it was a lunatic freaking tweet, end an entire civilization. There's not a person who read that other than like the bottom feeders who didn't understand exactly what he was saying, because they had already put out what that meant. Eliminating all the power plants and bridges, that will set a civilization back to the Stone Age. In our modern era, imagine right now, every power plant in this country is exploded in a way that is going to take a decade to fully rebuild. And every bridge, every major bridge across every chasm, canyon, and river is gone. We do have that capability. God, we shouldn't do it. But it is not the same as dropping nuclear bombs on every major target in the country, which is how people acted. I don't think that anybody is actually rationally analyzing this at all. I don't think the left is. I don't think the libertarian liberty movement is. And I damn sure don't think the right is. And I think the reason is that we can't definitively say anything right now. And since people hate that, everybody wants to finish the story. And they want to finish the story from everything Trump does is wrong, or I hate what's going on, so we must be losing, or rah, 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 fly, eagle, fly, we win all the time, number one, foam finger. And I don't think this can be analyzed that way, and I don't think we're going to know what the results will be for quite a while yet. And I don't know what they are. Now, where I will go completely over into the Dr. Paul, Dan McAdams camp, and I mean instantly, the second it happens, any significant attempt to occupy territory inside Iran, the second that happens, then you can make your comparison to Vietnam and Afghanistan. Because right now, I'm not going to say we're doing apples and oranges comparisons there. We're doing like a really delicious, big, beautiful Fuji apple fully ripe to a crab apple. They're both apples. They're both in the Malus family. They both have a wood that can be used for similar purposes, but they're not the same. My thoughts, let's move on to something totally different, selling your home by yourself or with a real estate agent with Anthony Gatto.
Hello, TSP community. This is Antonio Gatto coming to you again from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I'm always happy to answer all of your questions pertaining to home improvements and real estate. And this week's question comes in from Dan in New Jersey. Dan writes in, "Hello, Antonio. What are your thoughts or concerns on selling a property by way of FSBO, possibly with AI assistance versus using a realtor when selling a turnkey homestead? My wife and I plan to relocate to Tennessee this summer, and we are looking to sell a half-acre property in southern New Jersey that we have intentionally developed as a small food production homestead. The current setup is as follows. We have established laying chickens and meat rabbits, fruit trees, fodder trees, raspberries, and vines planted along the backyard perimeter. We also have a front yard orchard that was planted in the spring of 2025. And that includes apples, cherries, Asian pears, plums, peaches, figs, seaberry, and mulberry. And that should be entering early production in a year or two. Flower beds and medicinal herbs are planted in rows between the trees. Raised bed vegetable gardens are in the front yard, and we also have a paid-for grid-tied solar system. The property is essentially a turnkey homestead and would likely appeal most to someone who specifically wants food production systems already established. Based on prior evaluations, once remaining home maintenance is completed, the property would likely list around $450,000. Thank you for your time, and any input you could provide would be greatly appreciated. Dan in Southern New Jersey. Dan, thank you very much for sending in that question. It's a very good question, and it's a common one that comes up with couples and individuals that are looking to sell their home, and they question, should I list it as a FSBO, or should I go directly towards the avenue of hiring a real estate agent? And for those that are unfamiliar with that term, FSBO, folks, what that stands for is for sale by owner, just in case you're unfamiliar with that. So to answer your question, the best way that I can sum it up to you is it depends. But more of me is going to tell you to go with a realtor, and I'm going to give you some reasons as to why. I don't think that the average person understands how much work actually goes into selling a home. I think there's this general idea that the public thinks that a realtor literally just comes over, takes a few pictures, goes back to the office, lists it on the internet, and that's it, and then they collect the 6% commission. There's a lot more work that goes into it than that. I am a former realtor. I had my realtor's license for well over a decade, and I can tell you if you broke down the hours that you put into it, you would be very surprised to see how much work actually goes into it. So the reason I'm telling you all this is because you need to ask yourself the question, do you have the time to do this? Are you and your wife both working full time? If you are, you need to understand that you are going to be bombarded with phone calls. You are going to have to be making appointments for showings. You are going to have to list it. You are going to have to stage it, et cetera, et cetera. You are going to have to provide the proper documentation. You are going to have to be very familiar with real estate terminology. And if you're not, that really raises the question as to, you know, is this something that you really should be taking on, or should you leave it to a professional? And the second thing is you really need a lot of experience to sell a home and to do it in a successful way. And again, with the experience comes in, you know, do you know how to properly stage a home? Do you know how to market it properly? Can you do a good listing? Can you provide all the documentation? Do you understand sales agreements? Do you understand seller disclosures? Do you understand real estate terminology that you are going to be faced with when the time comes for negotiations and you're reading these actual sales agreements? These are the things that the realtor will be able to explain to you and does every day, which is why I always suggest that people go that route. And the other question to ask yourself, do you know how to properly negotiate, and are you good at it? You know, if you have a very competent realtor that has a good track record of 10 years, they should be very, very well off when it comes to negotiating that house for you. And it's really nice to have somebody on your side that does this for a living, that their goal is to get the highest amount possible for you. And with that being said, that also, the higher the price, that offsets their commission cost that will be coming out of your bottom line, and that also increases their incentive to sell the property as well too. So there's a win-win on both sides of that. So let's talk about the reasons as to why you should go with a realtor versus listing as a FSBO. And this is not my opinion. This is fact right here. So if you list with a realtor, historically speaking, those homes, they sell faster and they sell at a much higher price. And with that, you also get a much wider exposure when it comes to listing that home, because the realtors have access to what is known as the MLS, which is the multiple listing service. This is the largest platform that realtors use to list a home. That listing will show up into somebody's inbox once it falls under their search criteria, and it is only available to real estate agents and realtors. So that right there alone is a huge point as to why I always suggest that people go that route. And you also have to understand the management that is involved in that too. Again, they handle the staging, they handle the photography, they handle the showings, the negotiation. they really free up a lot of your time. And again, if you and your wife are working full time, it's going to take a huge load off of your shoulders, and it's going to go in a much more smooth manner. And they are also usually always affiliated with specific settlement companies. And that's another thing that FSBOs don't really take into account. You need to have a real estate attorney, and you need to be acquainted with a settlement company that can handle the actual closing of your house as well, too. And that is usually not an issue, and that's included in the fees that are charged by the realtors. And you will see all of that in your settlement statement. None of this will come to a surprise. Everything is itemized, and you will see exactly what you will end up with when it is all said and done. I can tell you, with all of the homes that I have bought and sold over the years and continue to do so, I will happily, and I do happily, pay a realtor's commission. With running two businesses, I simply don't have the time to go through all of the negotiations, the marketing, the listing. Can I do it? Yes, I did it for over a decade. I enjoy doing it, but I know the amount of work it takes to do a good job at it. I know the dedication that it takes, and it's very, very time consuming. And once you do it, you see it in a different light. And one thing in closing that I really want to point out to you, and I think a lot of people forget this perspective, just remember, the average real estate commission throughout the United States for residential property is between 5 and 7%. So let's just meet in the middle. Let's just say 6%. If your home sells at a 6% commission, try to keep the viewpoint that, just remember, you're going to be walking away with 94% of your home sale price. That's not a bad deal when you take everything into consideration that the realtor did for you and it made it as stress-free as possible. So I hope this gives you some good advice. I hope that it's easy for you to understand, Dan. If you have any more questions about that, feel free to reach out to Jack or reach out to me directly, and I will be happy to answer and guide you with any more questions that you have. As always, everybody stay safe, enjoy this beautiful warm weather that is finally upon us, and remember, never stop learning, and we will see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening.
So I'm gonna say some things that sound a little bit braggery, but it's not. It's just a statement of reality, and then I'm going to say, and I hired an agent anyway. Number one, I am an expert salesperson. I know how to sell better than I would guess probably 90 to 95% of people who sell for a living. I'm very good at it. I know how to sell. I also know how to market, and I'm one of the few people that knows how to sell and how to market as independent disciplines and then merge them back together. That is not a common trait. Again, I know I sound like bragging a little bit. I'm actually making the case for why you want a real estate agent, though. So on top of this, I understand what motivates buyers of real estate better than most people ever will. And I understand the concept of that all buyers are settlers, meaning even somebody with a $5 million budget is never going to get the house that they want, and they buy on what I call the 1% effect. Everything that's in their range, where they want to be, how much they can afford to spend, etc., they evaluate everything there, and the one that would separate itself from the pack by 1% in their mind is the one that they buy. Now, most real estate agents cannot tell you what I just told you. They don't understand how to put together a great marketing program, because real estate is so systemized by itself. They list it on MLS, etc. They take care of it. They do all the stuff he said, but I have never seen, other than one agent in my existence, put together a truly well-crafted marketing campaign for a property if that property was, let's say, under $500,000. And today, you're probably looking at million-dollar properties to get that kind of agent that does that kind of a real, consorted, specific marketing plan to market that house as if it were the only house they had listed. Okay? So they're not going to do any of that. This is where I think you need to default to hire an agent and actively manage them. And the way that I suggest you do that, and I know that he's going to sell us his book. I haven't heard from the guy that co-wrote it with me for years. He was paying me a small royalty, like we split the royalty on it, and it doesn't make that much money anyway. And I don't care about the money, but all I'm telling you is 1,000 people could buy this book today and I won't make a dollar, and I'm okay with that. Like, don't think I'm criticizing the person that put it together. I really don't care. He did all the work. He took all my material and formatted it into this book. I'm going to suggest you get that book. If you're on Kindle Unlimited, it's completely free. Go through it and build out what I'm telling you in the book. Take the approach of the improvements that are specific to move buyers, and put together, I tell you how to put together a book that you leave in the house, in my book, that when somebody looks at the house, it's a binder, it's sitting there, and it showcases all the things that make your house unique and wonderful and different from things everybody would care about, like where the best pizza place is, where the kids are going to go to school, all of that. But it also has things like who to call if the water heater breaks. And when you have unique things like gardens, fruit trees, and stuff, you kind of like showcase that. How do you water it? Like if you have irrigation in, like where everything is. You document everything like a user's manual for the home. This does two things. One, all the objections that the buyer might have, but how will I do this? What about that? I've never had a gas water, whatever it is, right? They're taken away before they get spoken. Here's your guide, right? Two, the person that does this, how much do they care about their house? In the mind of the buyer. When you see something like that, and I've only ever seen it once, and I learned it from a real estate agent in near Allentown, Pennsylvania, named Jane Wells Schooley. I don't remember the names of any of my other real estate agents. Maybe a first name, but not like that, because she made an impact. She taught me this approach, and then I expected to see it from other real estate agents. None of them effing can do it. None of them seem to know anything about this. You have to do that, plus you have to actively manage the person, meaning you have to make sure you stay in touch with them. When they tell you we're going to list your house on Wednesday and it's not on the listing on Wednesday, you need to ask them why. I've dealt with that. I dealt with an agent one time. I caught him in red-handed with it, and I finally made him admit it. He drug his feet from listing my home for 2 weeks because he thought he could sell it to somebody directly without actually listing it because he was a full-service agent. He didn't want to split the 6% commission 3-3 with a buyer's agent. Okay? He gave me all kinds of excuses, but when it came down to it, that's what he was doing. That's just one example. I had an agent when the house I was buying was underappraised, told me just come up with the full difference. You don't do that. Okay? You can put real estate in at the Survival Podcast. You can find me talk about this. Selling your house would be another good search term. I'll look and see if I can find where I outlined this whole thing and add that to the show notes. Now let's go ahead and hear from Nick Ferguson on Trehe.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with a question from Brandon on Trehe, but a quick note, we are still unfortunately waiting on the last of our tree orders to come in from the growers. It's kind of later than normal due to weather, nothing we can do about it, but we are working on bundling and order prep to get things ready to ship as soon as the last of those things come in. We're probably going to be shipping out an absolute crap ton to just about everybody because it's getting a little bit late for my comfort, but I'm going to answer Brandon's question now on Trehe, and he writes, Nick Ferguson, I live in Wisconsin. I'm looking for suggestions for harvesting and storing tree fodder for winter. We will be feeding goats, sheep, chickens, and rabbits on our farm and would like to know a few ways to store tree fodder to help feed our animals through winter. Thanks, Brandon. Great question on the tree fodder. I'll tell you the simplest way to harvest and store. It's how people did things for literally hundreds, if not thousands of years of recorded history. And I know this might be oversimplifying things a bit, but try to not overcomplicate it. Don't make this more complicated than it needs to be. You simply cut the smaller branches during the summer when the leaves are bright green and full of life. You haul those branches to a shady area. A shed is perfect for this. And you hang the branches up to dry in the shade with good airflow. That's it. You can bundle a handful of branches together before you hang it up, so it makes it easy to move those to the animals. I typically would use a biodegradable sisal, I don't know how to pronounce that, baling twine, but it's that, you know, the natural fiber baling twine. And just let it get good and dry, and you can either just keep it hung up like that until you use it, or if you're sure that it's bone dry, you can bundle those up tighter like a hay bale. You know, you can, you know, lay a whole bunch of them down on top of a couple strands of that string and then kind of smash them down or kind of roll them up into like a giant tree hay cigarette kind of thing and use this string to, you know, tighten it down and cinch it down so you can kind of pack that stuff into a barn or whatever. That's it. You can take that whole bundle and toss it to the critters, or you can hang it where they can strip the leaves off and just harvest it themselves. They'll pick up stuff that drops on the ground. Goats and sheep, pigs and cows will harvest all the leaves for you. They'll just strip it right off of the branches. Rabbits will too, but you're going to have to make sure you make smaller bundles of branches that you know, you can fit into the cages if you use cages like I do. Unless you do a colony setup, then you can put a big old bundle in there and just toss it on the ground. The chickens, you're probably going to need to beat the leaves off of the branches, remove them somehow, and mix those dried and crumbly leaves in with their normal layer ration at about 20% mulberry leaf to 80% of their normal feed by weight. For the chickens, however, honestly, I'd be using some of that fresh mulberry leaf to produce a bunch of black soldier fly larvae in the summertime and freezing them for winter feed. That's how you turn those fodder trees into really good poultry feed for winter. If you did that, added some carbohydrate crop and like 20% mulberry leaf, you could essentially feed your chickens for free all winter long. So yeah, if you want to get more complicated, you can strip the leaves and shred them into an airtight vessel or bag with some molasses water, maybe a little bit of salt, pack it tight, and ferment that white mulberry shredded leaf like silage or chaff hay. That fermenting process preserves more nutrients and keeps it a higher quality nutrition for longer. It's more complicated than I can get to on air, but it really is as simple as that, my dude. Try it out. And for anybody listening, I'm going to be starting to schedule my next short consulting tours towards the East Coast in the next month or so. So if you want someone to help you to craft a game plan and design your property to avoid costly mistakes, I'll be hitting the following states at least: Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, all hopefully before June, but we'll see how life goes. If you want to get on one of those tours, send me an email with consulting in the subject line to Nick, N-I-C-K, at homegrownliberty.com. Do good things.
And so I did not find the episode where I actually explained the 1% effect from Anthony Gatto's earlier segment. I know that we just had Nick. I just want to make sure I'm clear about what I did find for you. I do have a link to the book, and I do have a link to an episode where I talked about the 1% effect, so it's fully explained in reverse for how to manage yourself as a buyer so you know what you're looking at. So that should be enough to get a better grasp on it until I find that episode. I might redo that episode. I think it's a great topic, how to sell your house using the 1% effect. I should redo that episode. Obviously, it's been so long, I can't even find it with my own search function. Anyway, Nick Ferguson did a great piece there on tree hay. It's absolutely a really good way to go if you have the type of livestock that can be fed that way. It is incredibly easy to manage, incredibly effective, and it can cut a feed bill to very, very low or almost non-existent. Let's go on and talk about something else. So let's talk about expecting and modifying older firearms with Mike Melito from Good Shepherd Training.
Hey TSP, Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast. Today let's talk about bringing guns out of mothball and whether or not to modify older firearms. I hope you guys will forgive the audio quality here. This is probably going to be in the raw, like Jack Spirico's old Jetta days. I'm recording on the mobile with everything going on in the world, my op tempo is a bit up. Also, these are not direct questions. I got two questions and I have not answered them on the expert council because they were kind of myopic, really particular. So I responded to those people individually, but I thought if I combined them and made them a bit more general, it would make a good expert council segment. But that is for Jack to decide. Bringing older guns out of mothball, meaning they've been stored, maybe an older relative had them, or you've lived in an area where you couldn't use them. They've been in storage for years, maybe even decades. What you're going to have to do really depends on how they were stored. If they were stored well in a dry place and they were oiled before they were put away, probably not much is going to need to be done to them. Wiping them down with a lightly oiled rag and cleaning out the bore with either a bore snake or a cleaning rod and just putting a clean patch through there and making sure there's nothing crazy coming out of there, but make sure there's no residual oil or grease in the bore and no excessive grease in the internal parts. Like if they've got a lot of grease in the trigger or the firing pin channel, that could just give you some issues as far as getting them to work properly. But getting all that excess grease off, wiping them down with light oiled rags, making sure the bores are clean, and inspecting them just to make sure that there are no like really deep pits, corrosion, make sure the stocks didn't get cracked in transport or anything like that. You might look up how to get Cosmoline off if they were stored in like really thick grease. There are ways to do that. But most of the time, that's all that's going to be required. Just a light oil cloth, get rid of the excess grease, inspect for excess rust and pitting. Now, a lot of older guns are going to have some rust, right? You're probably going to rub them down if they were blued. They're going to have some light surface rust. That's not a big deal. That's not going to hurt anything except for aesthetics. I'm talking about deep pitting. If you are at all questionable on whether they are pitted or damaged so much you don't want to shoot them, take them to a competent gunsmith. It's worth it rather than getting injured. You should always wear eye protection and ear protection, but especially here wear the eye protection if you're going to fire those guns, but just because there might be, you know, extra grease and oil and stuff that flings back in your eyes, and that can be unpleasant. A couple of caveats. Make sure you know the caliber. Don't assume. Like, it should be stamped on the barrel or the receiver. If it doesn't say the caliber, don't assume it. Have that checked out, again, by a competent gunsmith. If it's some kind of wildcat that people, you know, wildcatted something like a 6.5-06 that wasn't standard back in the day, make sure you have that, you know, chamber measured, because there's not going to be a set standard for that for those older guns. But here's the thing, and why I didn't think it was worth an entire segment on its own, is that guns are really rugged, reliable machines. They're meant to go, you know, lifetimes of hard use if they're even remotely taken care of well. So I would not stress about it. It's not like a gun made 30 years ago is not as good as or inferior to, as far as durability goes, most modern guns. They're fine, and they're meant to be used for generations. So don't stress about it. Just use some common sense, inspect to make sure there's nothing crazy, and have fun. Enjoy. Now, what if you have an older gun, but coming out of mothball, or you just have an older gun that you inherited or got for a good deal at a gun show, and it's an older, non-common model of gun? Should you modify it? Well, that depends. Let's take the sentimental value and put that on the shelf, because that's something you have to evaluate for yourself. The sentimental value, take that and put it aside. Is it a highly collectible firearm? Almost always, if you modify those, you're going to destroy the collector value. Like, if you were going to modify a 1903 Springfield, probably don't modify an all-matching original 1903 Springfield with matching serial numbers. Find one that's already been sporterized, that doesn't have much collector value, and continue to modify it. That would be an example. What if it's not an old military collectible? What if it's just like a shotgun? Well, here's the thing. If it's just like a, not just, they're great shotguns, but a Remington 870 or a Mossberg 500, there are so many of those. If you find an older one and you want to modify it, go ahead. Like, there's a lot of aftermarket support. There's a lot of aftermarket parts. If you, for some reason, you just ruin it, right, you could get another Mossberg 500 or Remington 870. Now, if it's something a little bit more esoteric or an older, rarer gun, like a Winchester Model 12 Featherweight, you're going to have to decide whether you want to do that or not. Right? I wouldn't go like silver soldering on, you know, ghost ring sights on my old Winchester Model 12 Featherweight if I had one. I wouldn't go and take off the original mag tube and put an extended mag tube on there and try and make it some kind of tactical masterpiece. I would enjoy it for what it is. If you wanted to do some basic stuff, like, you know, upgrade the springs or something like that, it wouldn't bother me. The idea that sparked this was a guy wrote in about his, it was an older Winchester, it was a semi-auto, it was not a common gun, and he wanted to modify it. It's your gun, you can do what you want, but I would probably just get a more common gun and modify it. You can get a decent pump action shotgun for not a lot of money, or a decent semi-auto. Those older Winchesters, that specific model, is really known for being a fantastic shotgun. So I'd probably just keep it for what it is, assuming that it worked well. I wouldn't permanently modify it. If you want to feel like a mag tube extension on it that you can take off, no big deal. I wouldn't drill it and tap it or silver solder the barrel for ghost ring sights or, you know, turn it into black multicam or something. I just wouldn't do that to that shotgun. That's me. It's your gun. You do what you want with it. But those are some thoughts in general. Each case is going to be individual. Again, how common is the platform? It's something like a 30-year-old Ruger 10/22. Well, unless it's some crazy unique thing, go ahead and modify away. Chop it up. You know, if you mess it up, you probably aren't going to mess up the receiver and you can get all the original parts. If it's something more rare, let's stick with Ruger. If it's a Ruger flat top, which is the early model of the Blackhawk, they're kind of rare and coveted. Right, if you want to throw new grips on that, go ahead. But I wouldn't go chopping down the barrel and Cerakoting it and all that stuff because, again, it's pretty rare and collectible. So just keep that for what it is. And just tangentially related, if you're looking for a gun to modify, you might look for one that's already been modernized or sporterized and save some money that way. Just some thoughts on the topic. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP. Have a blessed day.
Great stuff from Mike. And as much as I love to find older weapons and restore them or do some modification projects using MilSERP, always think about what you're doing, because what seems like not that big a deal today could totally change them all. I think we've been through the big flux with that, but I remember when you could buy like 3 6.5 millimeter Swedish Mausers for like $180. I remember when the SKSs first started coming out of like Yugoslavia and you could buy them, you know, out of a crate, never issued, wrapped in Cosmoline paper for $75. Those days are long gone. And those almost, you know, all those things like that are certainly worth more money today untouched than modified. The other side of it is I believe that guns are tools that we buy to fill a need or a want in our, let's say, a gun portfolio. And if you want to do something, there's no reason you can't do it. Just know what you're doing when you do it and know what you might be doing in the future if you don't think about it fully first. But otherwise, great stuff from Mike. Let's now talk about correcting unwanted behavior in your dogs, which is an ongoing subject. And there's going to be some specific behaviors here, but you'll start to see the pattern, the pattern that Joel uses with training dogs, which is create a condition where the dog can fail, control the condition so that the dog doesn't fail catastrophically so nothing bad happens, and then correct the behavior when it's not what you want and reward the positive behavior to condition a response. That's the 3 C's, create, control, and correct. And then just another really quick reminder, this is that segment that somehow got defrayed in my email program, and I just found it today. And it's from the fall of last year. So he mentions a sale on puppies, which I don't think is still running. But, you know, like I said, you can always ask for a deal and see what you get. Anyway, let's hear from Joel.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you with another expert counsel segment. We are still working our way through Chris's email with his questions. He had a lot of great questions. And so this is going to be part 3. Now, the other question that he had was about chewing things, right? Just liking to dig and liking to chew things. Well, first of all, when a dog is young and they're still teething and their adult teeth are still coming in, they have a need to chew. So you want to provide something that's good for them to chew on, right? Either one of the Nyla bones, you can use real bones. I don't really like the big, like, beef bones and things like that because those bones are harder than most dogs' teeth. And they will wear their teeth down chewing on them. So I like the hard plastic types of chew toys. I do not like soft stuff chew toys because they will rip them up and eat the padding inside of them. And most of the time they pass that, but sometimes it gets impacted in their intestines and you have to go in and do $3,000 worth of surgery to get it out. So I don't like the soft toys unless I'm sitting there playing with them And there's some applications to that. But if I just want my dog to have something to chew and I can just kind of focus on other things, I give them the hard chew toys. I like the wishbone shapes. There's some bone shapes. See what your dog likes. And you can get very different flavors in them and stuff like that. Those are all pretty good for the dogs. So I do want them to have a thing that they can chew on, so that anytime they start to chew on something that they're not allowed to chew on, whether that's a pillow off the couch, whether it's a table leg of an end table, whether it's something that I don't want them to chew on, I give them a correction. I say, fooey that, so that they know, don't chew on that. And then I get the thing they're allowed to chew on, I give it to them, and then I praise them and reward them for chewing on the thing that they're allowed to chew on. So they learn, chew on these things, don't chew on those things. The other thing that you can do, especially if they're, like, say, in the yard, right? And they're just kind of running around in the yard, and they're sometimes chewing on things you don't want. You can use an e-collar, and when I use e-collars in this application, I don't want the dog to associate me with the correction. So the first thing I do is get the e-collar, charge it up, put it on the dog, and don't do anything for, like, 2 or 3 days. And then I observe the dog outside, and if they start to dig in the yard, I give them a pop on the e-collar. I start relatively low on these because these aren't like things that are really going to damage property or hurt things. And I want it to be maybe like between 30% and 50%, and then I'll dial up as needed, okay? And when they do a thing that I don't want, I just pop them. So you dig in the yard, hey, if you dig in the yard, you get shocked. Something down there in that dirt shocks you, and so stop doing that. If you chew on something you're not supposed to, you get shocked. If I'm outside with the dog, let's say I'm outside doing, you know, yard work or whatever, and I'm just kind of watching the dog as they're doing their stuff, and I'm giving them bumps as needed, if they come run up to me, like, holy crap, I just got shot. My reaction to that is, what happened, buddy? Oh, I guess we shouldn't dig anymore, right? Or what happened? Oh, we shouldn't put our teeth on that. It'll shock you. And that way, they're not looking around to see if I'm out there before they do the thing and get shocked, or don't get shocked because I'm not there to do it. And they'll learn real quick, if you're associated with that, if you're not around, I can do it. But if you are there, then I don't do it. So I don't want them to associate the correction they're getting on that e-collar with me in those situations. So that's how I work, chewing on things, digging, and stuff like that. However, again, keep in mind, if your dog is with you, especially in the beginning, most of the time, then you're going to have a lead. And if they start to do those things, boy, that leave it alone, right? I can give them a little pop. No, we're not doing that. I don't want you to dig. I don't want you to chew on that thing. Here's the thing you can chew on, right? And it makes that whole part of it very simple. Like, my dogs love to chew on their chew toys, but they almost never chew anything else because when I'm working them, they're with me. If I have a dog on a table like I do right now and there's things up on the table and I notice them come over and start to chew on something, I just grab the lead. I give them a bump, fooey that, leave it alone. They stop chewing on things, right? I might go get one of the plastic toys I have over there on the floor and hand it to them and say, here, you can chew on this, right? If I need to, I'll move the other things away. I'll give them the thing they can chew on so that while I'm sitting across the room and I see them chewing on the thing they're supposed to chew on, I can go, good, get it, good, chew, or whatever command you want to use to praise the dog so that they know, oh, I'm doing something that my handler wants right now. They're happy with me. Good. And then when they do something where they put their teeth on something else that you don't want, you can give them the correction and they learn, just these things that my handler gives me, these are my toys, I can chew on these things. All right, so I hope that's been helpful for you. We already talked about Canine Academy, but go over to Jack's website if you want more details on training your dog. If you are looking to buy a fully trained dog or a working line puppy, we breed Malinois, Dutch Shepherds, and German Shepherds. We almost never do this, but we have a 20% off sale right now. That's $500 off on a puppy purchase. That goes for our basic puppies and our advanced puppies. And if you're interested in that, go visit fortresscanine.com. You can click on our puppy page. You can click on the consult form and send me a consultation that comes into my emails. And I will reach out to you and we will get you all the details and get you set up if that's something that you're looking to do. So remember, until next time, train hard and stay safe.
Great advice from Joel as always. Again, I don't know about any sale on any puppies, but you should still check out the puppies and the dogs because they're really cool. And remember, Joel's also a sponsor of the show with his online training academy, canineacademy.us. All right, with that, let's go ahead and I want to get into my subject. And I think this is kind of fascinating, and we really are just figuring out all the things that we're going to be able to do with AI. So for those that have not heard me talk about this, I did finish my second book, my second single author full-on book, which is Laws of Life Book 2. It, along with the second edition, revised and corrected version of Book 1, will be coming out within a few months. I'm pretty excited about both of those, having them as a set. In my plans, I was going to write my third book and make a trio of this set, and that book is codenamed North Star. And I'm not going to even tell you what it was about directly at this time, because I have other things in the way. During the run-up and finishing of Book 2 of Laws of Life, and all the work that I was doing with AI and developing certain things for AI, I came upon this concept that I'm working with here that I'm only going to say a little bit about. Additionally, you know, this is how fast this moves, man. Just a few weeks ago, I was doing a live stream, and one of you guys said to me something about me, myself, and AI. And I said, jokingly, I'm going to steal that. And the guy's like, go for it. And that formulated into the concept for this book. Within a day, I had ferreted out basically a 24-chapter outline analysis of what I wanted to do, and I built into the framework that I was already using. I strengthened the framework, and then I started building the framework for myself and writing the book using the methods in the book that the book is about, right? Just kind of crazy. And I started actually writing Monday. So we are on Thursday, so it's been 2 days. I have drafted the first two chapters, and I have been using a creative writing assistant that I spun up using Google Gemini so that I have broader experience as I write this book. I've always used Gemini and GPT, but I've leaned on GPT. And so I'm trying to make the techniques work on both platforms so people read the book. If it'll work on those two, they're so divergent, it'll work on Grok or Llama or whatever, right? And to make it vendor agnostic is what I want to do. Well, as I'm going through it, I decide, well, what I'm going to do, and I did this Tuesday morning after I got done with chapter one, at least the draft run of it, I dropped a PDF of it into Notebook LM. If you've not heard of this, it's a Google tool, and what it does a lot of things. But one of the things it's really known for is you can create a podcast-like discussion. It uses two AI entities, a male and female voice, to discuss it the way it would be discussed on a podcaster. I've been using that for a long time. I get a complex article or something I want to know more about. I have time to sit there and read it for 30 minutes. I'll generate a 15-minute discussion podcast about it, and I can multitask and listen to it. And it's not a perfect system, but it's pretty damn good. So I figure I'll do that with my own book. And while I'm out in the garden or whatever, I'll listen to it, and that'll help me form new ideas and reinforce things and correct it. So I do that, and I notice when I do that, when I'm on the computer not using the app, like from the App Store, that when I go to do the audio, it says that I can have it do multiple things, long, short, medium. That was already there. But I could also have it do things like be critical. So both of them are being critical. But what I found way more interesting, debate. Debate mode. Debate mode, the one character takes the pro stance and the other character takes the anti stance, like that argues against the supposition of whatever you're presenting in front of them. You learn a lot from well-articulated debates. So I loaded up and I listened to this debate, and I want criticism because I want to make it better, but the criticism is completely not in line with reality. The criticism is things like, but this guy doesn't know anything about running a company because he's a podcaster and an author. Well, you guys that know me know how far out of left field that is. Well, I didn't write anything about, for instance, my background into that chapter, because I figure if you buy my book, you know who I am. But I realized this is chapter one. Plenty of people buy books, they don't really know who the author is. They don't know their history. They don't read the author's bio and like, take it all in. They start reading the book. And if they come away with instantly feeling that way, I can lose that person before they ever give it a shot. So I went through and I found like, and I made notes while I listened to this. I found like 5 bullet points of objections that were not, he's wrong, right? But he's wrong because, and it was my fault that they thought that because. So I then took those critiques, went to my creative writing assistant, walked through what should I address, how should I address it. Then I made very simple revisions to the draft chapter. A sentence here, 3 sentences there, change a word or two here. Like for one thing I did is I got rid of the word, I was using the word renegade, for people that just act without waiting for permission. And I changed that to digital pioneer. That was with the assistance of my creative writing assistant. I then took the PDF of the new draft, re-uploaded it to a complete new notebook LM project, and said, okay, now give me the debate. The same debate. The entire debate changed. The debate went from all the reasons to attack me and all the reasons to attack the methodology, and it went away. And the debate became, what he says is coming isn't. I'm fine with that. And the objections that remained by the antagonist side were all objections I would expect to hear and will be covered later. And so the tightening that I was able to do on that one chapter in a day and a half blew my mind. Like I said, if I was writing a horror book, I feel like I have Stephen King on speed dial right now. In fact, I feel like I have a whole group of very articulate authors that understand my subject matter on speed dial to help me work through this. On top of this, I've never just tried these features before, but they have a tool that when you upload material like that will make a presentation deck, like for a speaker, or a really detailed deck that's more like for a student. So I had it spit out basically a PowerPoint that I could stand in front of a room with and present that chapter as like a 6-slide presentation that would take about 30 to 40 minutes to present. I'm not going to say it was perfect. It was so good. I probably could use it and nobody would notice that it wasn't perfect, because how much do you read the infographic type parts of a PowerPoint like that? But I could have spent five minutes editing it. And I would have put it in front, I would have stood in front of a boardroom, I would have stood in front of a 1,000 headcount seminar and presented off that deck. Because I knew the content, because I wrote it, I know how to present it. And it was a perfect visual aid. It also spit out an infographic. I've just done that with chapter two. I started Monday, it's Thursday, I'm done with two chapters because of these tools stacked together. But the notebook LM leverage is amazing. And this is what I'm going to tell you about using it. You don't have to be an author, just an author of something. If you were putting together anything, now again, and I got to make sure that this is in the book over and over again, because like it keeps coming up with people. Obviously, if you work for a company and there's proprietary information, if there's anything that would not be okay to be seen outside of the walls of your building, you can't put it in a third-party AI tool, because that is, even though, like, trust me, bro, we don't share your information, not necessarily true, right? But if you would have the conversation with a friend that might maybe sort of kind of tell somebody else by accident sometimes, then you could probably do it there. It's like you have to make your own call there. But if you were putting together any kind of a proposal, throw that thing into a document, shove that into Notebook LM, and give the debaters instructions. Because that's one of the functions that you can do. I want one to take this side, one to take that side. Argue it from this angle. And you can say things like, I want the antagonist to be brutal and their criticism. And you can even set the viewpoint, the role. Remember context, role, interview, task, the crit method? You can use a piece of that here. I want this debater to act as a person with 15 years of experience and blah, 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 blah. And I want the person that takes the pro case to operate as a person with blah, 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 blah. And listen to it. It will radically transform your understanding of your own work. On top of it, the deep dive, which is the one that most people use, which is where they just like discuss it like, oh, wow, it's great. That's fantastic, too. Some of the, like, I picked up, like, just from my own work, from my first chapter, like 8 bullet points I pulled out and mapped to other chapters. I picked up terminology and words I would have never used. Then I synthesized them in a way that made them my own, that made the messaging more powerful. I probably have already just today changed the subtitle of the book. Because one thing that came out of the review of chapter two, I was like, oh my God, how did I not see that? And I'll just put it this way. They used the word survival. And I went, wait a minute, how the hell did I not see that? This is fantastic stuff, and I encourage you to consider using it. And there's a lot of other things I haven't played with yet. Like, you can use it to generate quizzes, flashcards to study. Like, it was really built for students. is what it seems like. This suite was built for students, but it's coming into its own. It's one of the most powerful creative tools if you're actually creating something. So you have to create it first, then you push it through there, and it's like giving it to a committee to tear it apart and build it up at the same time. And again, the software is, or the app, I guess, is called Notebook LM, and it is made by Google. And one of the things I like about the Google suite, as I work with it more, Gemini, etc., is you can link things together. Like, you can tie your Google Docs and Drive to your Gemini account. So, again, I'm trying to do everything vendor agnostic at this point, but this is pretty exciting. On the AI front, of course, May the 4th be with you. Yes, on May the 4th, we are having round 4 of the AI course for solopreneurs. And trust me, my guidance as you go through that course gets better every time I do it. And a lot of the things that I'm working on now are going to be available in round 4 of the course. This is the good news. But I already took the course, and you should know that. Everybody who already took the course has access to retake any round they want whenever they want. So you have that if you've already bought. If you haven't taken the course, it's going to sell out. Sold out the last 3 times. It's going to sell out this time. It's going to sell out fast. Last time it took a little bit to sell out because it was like pushing right up against Christmas. I expected it. You know, we had to make it fit into our schedules. This time there's a big load lead up to it. This time it's going to be better than ever. The only way you're going to get a shot at taking this course is right now. Don't delay. Go to jackslaws.com. Up at the top, you should see a banner to go ahead and fill out a form. Actually, right now, you don't even need a banner. Tom did make the modification I asked him to. Just the front page of Jack's Laws. You're going to see a form to fill out that says stop playing with AI and start building with it. Check that out. Fill that form out. All that's going to happen is you're going to get a couple emails as we lead up to the launch date, and then the day of the launch, you'll get an email about, and you'll know when it's going to be. You'll get an email, though, about 15 minutes, hey, it's time, and there'll be a countdown, and then basically we have a queue set up, and as you try to get in, you try to get in, and once there's 100 people in, we cut off signups. And so we've got that mapped out really well now. We've learned from our first 3 sales how to do it perfectly, and so 100 in and done. That's how it's going to be. Again, the course is AI, Become Dangerous with ChatGPT, a 40-day master course for solopreneurs. If you want to build a business or you already have a business you want to take to another level and you want to learn my method for marketing and managing a business and turn AI into basically me with, you know, doing work on a daily basis, receiving prompts and guidance, you want to take this course. Everybody, I'll put it this way, I haven't had any real criticism from the course. The only criticism I've gotten so far is one person complained that I don't tell you how to manage your storage of your files, as in where you put your prompt libraries and things. That's not what the course does. Like, they wanted guidance for how to organize all their data. That's something that I find personal, but students help each other with that. And another one said that the work is too hard. Well, I didn't say it would be easy. I said it would be simple, as in something you can do, and I said it would be effective. I don't believe that the work is hard. I believe the work requires dedication. It requires about 30 minutes a day, and you have to stay on it. And when you don't, this is what I see happen to people. I'll catch up tomorrow, and now you have 2 hours worth of work. And you say, well, it can't be done in 30 minutes a day. Well, it can be if you do it every day. So if you will set aside the time, if you will follow the prompts, if you will finish with your class, it will radically transform the way you run your business and its effectiveness. And if you do not have a business yet, it will help you form the plan for the business so you can launch it and get it off the ground. If you are not looking to have a business, if you do not have a business or do not want one, or if you have no idea what you want to do with a business yet, I'm going to tell you, this is very anti-salesy, but do not buy this. It is built for what I just said. That's what it's for. I designed it that way from the very beginning. With that, we are ready to wrap up and sign off for the week. Some reminders, again, we brought on the Case Plays. If you go to the website, you should see the announcement about it either right at the top or just under today's episode if you're listening, you know, kind of as the episode drops. You'll also see their banner over in the right-hand column. You can click there and learn more about what they do. 50 to 80% off brands like Pelican. Right, brands like Hardig and SKB. This is top level stuff, and then an additional 10% for offer MSB members. That's a big win for the quarter. It's definitely a big win for the week for you guys and for me as well. I probably should have picked some stuff out blind before I put it up there on the air. You probably know some of the stuff's in limited supply, right? I haven't always taken my own lesson about that to heart. But this is good stuff, so check it out. If you're not an MSB member, man, this is just another great reason to become a member. If you just find two or three companies that you buy stuff from a year in our list of vendors, your membership pays for itself. And then last but not least, remember you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at TSPAZ. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you shop there, you help us out no matter what it is that you eventually buy. We had some really great items of the day this week. I don't have a new one for you today, but just a real quick recap of what we brought you this week. And these will all be in the show notes if you want to find them. We brought you the Energizer Power Failure Lights this week. These are fantastic. Plug them in the outlets in your home, and when the power goes out, they turn on like a night light, and you can pick them up like a flashlight, see where you're going, and when your eyes have soap in them and the lights went out and you're in the bathroom and your kid's crying down the hallway, you can actually find your way to them, and maybe if the lights come on, they won't cry. The Turkish-made folding, harvesting, and pruning knives, these are back in stock. They come in through a single importer out of Turkey. It is a fantastic tool. You can learn more about that. And the Olatin's TO58 folding titanium scalpel, one of the best pieces of EDC kit I have ever found. So check that out, and remember, you can always help us by shopping at tspaz.com. With that, I sign off, folks, and I end yet another fantastic week here at the Survival Podcast. Take the weekend, make something great of it, build something in your life, and I'll catch you again on Monday. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month. You never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.